All right. So welcome to our discussion of medical ethics, Jewish versus general medical ethics. And this is a wonderful sisterhood luncheon opportunity. The basis of general medical ethics, as outlined in this book, The Principles of Biomedical Ethics by Beecham and Childress, the four principles of general secular medical ethics are autonomy, that everyone has a right to decide for themselves, or that if they're incapacitated, then their family could decide for them. Non-malfeasance, that is that we don't want to do any harm. That's the famous, you know, Hippocratic Oath. You shall do no harm. Obviously, you don't want to cause death. Beneficence, you want to try to be generous and kind to the patient. And justice, and the justice is more of a modern, a newer kind of introduction into this. So the fourth category of justice relates to the modern ethos of making sure that we give equal justice to all, equal medical treatment to all. We don't want to turn someone away because they can't afford the medical care. There's a law like that. You can't turn someone away who's in need of care from the hospital. You want to make sure that Black people, white people, Hispanics, everyone, Jews are treated equally. So there's justice. And of course, you know, society is not built that way. There are certain disparities of healthcare that sort of built into the system, poverty, ignorance, suspicion, all kinds of different things, but hopefully have justice. So which one of these four things would be most challenging from a halachic perspective? Which would you think is most different in Jewish medical ethics? Which one is what's the tricky one? Which one doesn't belong?
Autonomy?
Correct. I mean, I don't mean correct, but that's the one I was thinking about. Right, autonomy. Why?
Because people have different choices. They're not following any rules, maybe.
Right. So if you have a halachic system, you have a Torah system, how can you have autonomy? The Torah says, in this circumstance, you have to do this. So how could you have autonomy? So we're going to have to look at that. Does Judaism recognize that fourth pillar of medical ethics, autonomy? Certainly the other ones, we don't want to do any harm. It's forbidden to kill, to hurt, to injure. We want to be beneficent, kindness, chesed, kindness. But and if everyone could please mute. But what about autonomy? So let's look at that one. But before we get to that, the basis for Jewish medical ethics. So, you know, I could throw in the kitchen sink. I could throw in many things, but it's a balance between the value of human life. How valuable is human life? Well, you could even violate Shabbos to preserve it, right? I could drive Bluma to the hospital to preserve, so you could have a baby or something. The desire to prevent pain. So that's interesting that we're going to have to prove that. Where does it say in Jewish life that you have to prevent pain? To love our neighbor. The Talmud says that if you have a choice between death penalty A, death penalty B, then you should choose for them a good death. Give them the type of death that's better than the other one. And while that situation of death penalty may seem kind of moot to us today, but it has a good application to this. If someone is dying, you want to give them a way that they can die, you know, most painlessly and not in a difficult way. Of course, we have do not murder and do not prolong death. We have to prove that. May be surprising to you to hear that, but do not prolong death. That's also something we don't want to just drag out someone being in suffering and pain. And then we have an obligation to heal. There's a phrase in Parshat Mishpatim where it says, you shall surely heal. We take as a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah for a doctor or someone who knows how to heal, a nurse or a dental hygienist, it's a mitzvah to heal, to help them heal. So these are some of our bases. I'm getting a little more specific. But again, you know, obviously you want to treat the stranger differently. So there's some justice elements. You don't want to murder. That's like malfeasance. Beneficence, you want to love your neighbor. So that's similar. The autonomy one seems a little more problematic. We'll get to that.
Can I ask a question,
sure,
Rabbi?
Sure.
On do not prolong death. That seems opposite than the one that says do not hasten. You can't hasten death, but...
Right. So that's exactly when you're dealing with end of life issues, that's exactly the tension between don't prolong the death and don't hasten the death. Right. So you don't want to do anything to hasten the death. You don't want to do anything to prolong the life. Let's say we can say person is on a ventilator, you know what that looks like? You know, they're it's not pretty, and something down their throat, and they have all these tubes and different things. And we say, oh, if we give them this antibiotic, we could keep them going for another week like this. So is that a good thing or not? So we have to talk about that. So that tension between not wanting to prolong the death, we don't want to hasten his death. Maybe we take out the ventilator. Maybe we're hastening the death. So yes, it's a tremendous, delicate balance, and we're going to have to look at that. Thank you.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Yes.
If one has a living will and it do not resuscitate water in there, is that considered hastening death?
Right. So sometimes do not resuscitate just means that if someone dies, then they're not going to do chest compressions and we're not going to intubate you. So that's what it basically means. So some would argue, well, he's dead. The person's dead anyway. So there's no obligation to heal. Other people would say, since we have the possibility today, we know how to revive people, like Elijah the prophet who revived that boy in the story in the Haftarah. So maybe we do have an obligation to keep reviving. So you know, there's also a big difference. Let's say, God forbid, a 20-year-old gets into a car accident, and they decided that they wouldn't want to be on a respirator. But if you put them on a respirator, maybe they could, they could get them back to life. That's different from being on a respirator. Or that being resuscitated. Well, let's say right now, I faint right now, right? Someone in this call had a relative who fainted in shul, and the doctor said they were dead, and they moved their feet up and they came back to life. So so most people would want to be resuscitated in a simple kind of way. But the problem is when the person's already fatally ill, no chance of living, no chance of being conscious or anything else, and then you say do not resuscitate and don't put... so. The question is, by not putting them on the respirator, are you simply making sure that you don't prolong this death process of them being on a ventilator for another week? Or are you hastening their death? So that's the question. Are there those who allow DNR? Yeah, under those circumstances where there's no chance of recovery, then there could be some possibility. For exact questions, for particular, we're going to talk about a lot of bottom lines here today, but if you have an exact question, should always try to bring it to me, and I'll research it, look at it very carefully.
I have a question.
There could be certain yes.
Obligation to heal. What about if someone is in a swimming pool, jumps in or something, and is about to drown, and so when you get them out, this is just an example. CPR is given. What is the difference then? Is there any difference between the do not resuscitate on the ventilators and the CPR?
There is no difference. The difference is that people will sometimes say DNR when the question always is when. What I like about certain healthcare proxy documents is that they say, if I am in a vegetative state and the doctors say that there's little or no chance of recovery, then I do not want to resuscitate.
Okay.
That should be the question. Someone, a 20-year-old, said, "Don't DNR? I don't like being on a ventilator. DNR." Well, or an 80-year-old person, a 90-year-old person says that, and they had a moment where they fainted in shul. So resuscitate them, come back to life, they go back to shul. So who wouldn't want to do that, right?
It would be right.
So the question is there any chance? So that's when we get to the question. So now the first impulse is, of course, there's a value of human life. Of course, we want to heal. We have to resuscitate them. But then the second question is, are we simply prolonging their death? Because before they needed that ventilator or that chest compression, you know what they were? They were vegetative, and they were extremely unlikely to ever recover. So then that's when people put a DNR. To put a DNR earlier than that, that could be a violation of the notion of healing and the preservation of life. Good.
Thank you.
Sure. Talmud and Ketubot, brought by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, to answer the question, is it always necessary to lengthen life? You have a certain compulsion because of this value, of the value of human life. It's such a primary value. You look at Israel, they're giving out vaccines like crazy, right? At the beginning of they'll go to the end of the earth to save one Jewish guy who got captured someplace. the value of human life. It's such a great value. So is there ever a case where is it always necessary to lengthen life? So we have a famous story. The maidservant, the slave, let's be honest, of Rabbi Judah the prince, who liked him very much, ascended the roof, and she says to God like this. She says to God, she makes the following prayer. This is a slave woman, but very valued, very honored woman in the Talmud, because she was the maidservant of this great rabbi who wrote the Mishnah, who organized the Mishnah. So she says to God, the upper realms are requesting the presence of Rabbi Judah the prince. In other words, it's written in the cards that he's going to die. And the lower realms are requesting the presence of Rabbi Judah the prince, that the people in the Beis Medrash, in the yeshiva, in the shul, they're praying that he should live. They want to keep him down here. They need the rabbi. May it be the will of God that the lower world should impose their will upon the upper world. So she said to God, may the rabbis who are praying defeat the angels who want him to die. However, when she saw how many times he would enter the bathroom and remove his phylacteries, you know that you're not allowed to go into the bathroom with your tefillin. But he wore his tefillin all the time. But he had to go to the bathroom all the time. So he went in the bathroom, took off his tefillin, went in the bathroom, came back, put his tefillin on. And let's say he's old and he's sick, so he's putting it on slowly. Finally puts him on, has to go to the bathroom, takes off his tefillin, goes back to the bathroom. And his whole life was tefillin, bathroom, tefillin, bathroom. And she saw this and how he was suffering with his intestinal disease. She said, may it be the will of God that the upper world should impose their will in the lower world, that the decree from heaven to kill him should overcome the rabbis who were praying for his life. So it seems that there comes a point where life is so indignant and life is so it has lowered the person to such indignity and such suffering that it's better not to be alive. Now, this seems very extreme because if he's well enough to put on his tefillin, I don't know, it sounds like he's half awake. So that's pretty extreme. But surely there could be a point, as we said, certainly a vegetative state where the doctor says there's no chance of recovering, that might be a case where you might ask for mercy, might pray for mercy. Now, we're not allowed to kill him, right? We can't say, all right, give him a high dose of morphine, done with it. We can't do that. That would be active killing. No, we have a basic principle, thou shalt not kill, do not murder. But as far as praying for their death, it could be appropriate to say, I pray that they find peace in heaven.
You bring up a point about that's where autonomy might come in. If a person has a disease that is irreversible and they have made a wish to their family that when they know that it's the end, they can no longer do anything, but they're going to give a signal, let's say that it's time, and they have arranged with a medical doctor to let them take some kind of medicine or something to end it. That was so is that, again, I know what you're saying, but would there ever be an exception, because that person is dying, you're prolonging death, there's no end. I mean, the person can't breathe, they can't do anything, they're huffing for breath, and so they just want to die in peace. Is that ever an exception, or there is no exception?
We're going to see a case of where the autonomy is very is strongly valued, at least by some rabbis. We'll see that in a moment. But as to whether you can take an active role where you take a specific pill or treatment that stops your life, we have to go back to do not murder. That becomes active euthanasia. To actively kill, no. But as far as withdrawing treatment, say, look, I get to point X, and they say, I'm only going to live 1 month, and this, but there's a trial in cancer, and maybe I would live. I'm not interested. I don't want my hair to fall out. I don't want to do anything. Leave me alone. So that might be in the realm of autonomy, even in Jewish law. I don't want to suffer. I don't want to go through the treatments. There aren't many, there's not much chance I'll live anyway. There may be some chance of that. But as far as taking a particular pill, even in most states in America, it's forbidden because that's active euthanasia, and that would be malfeasance, right? That would be malfeasance. Is it a mitzvah to alleviate pain? What's the mitzvah? What's the mitzvah to alleviate? Who says it's a mitzvah to alleviate pain? So there's healing. So Reb Shlomo Zalman Urbach, one of the great decisors of Jewish law in Israel, till, I don't know, 10 years ago, he passed away. It's part of loving your neighbor. We mentioned that Talmud interprets that when you love your neighbor, you choose for them a good death, even when you're executing them. So certainly when you're caring for them, you choose a good death. You alleviate pain. Eliezer Waldenberg said that pain is like a physical malady. And you have to, just like you have to heal physical maladies, you have to heal pain. So it's a mitzvah to alleviate pain, either as a matter of loving your neighbor or as a matter of the obligation to heal. Now, if you look at healthcare proxies, there are two types. One says, who's going to make the decisions? Oh, not me. There's a great rabbi, and he's going to decide. Rabbi so-and-so, he has all the deciding power. That's the Aguda healthcare proxy. My rabbi is Rabbi X. He'll make all the decisions. That's one type of healthcare proxy. The old RCA healthcare proxy said, in case X, if I'm in a vegetative state and I'm not likely to recover, then I would like X. And the patient decides in their proxy what they want to do. Rav Herschel Schechter said that the second type of healthcare proxy is okay. It's okay that you make certain decisions. You have some autonomy. Just like you choose how to eat, right? I may have a gooey piece of cake with sugar on top for lunch today. Aren't I hastening my death? Eventually, that type of behavior will get me. That's my choice. I choose how to live, and to some degree, I choose how to die. Again, I can't take the pill to die, but I can choose. I'd rather die than have such and such indignity. So some people think there is that kind of autonomy. What if you take the approach that the patient should eat, but he or she doesn't want to? Let's say you say, look, they're not in a vegetative state. They have some chance of recovery. They're alive and well at this moment, although they have cancer, different things. So, but they say, I don't want to eat. I'm done. I just spoke to someone yesterday. They were done. Someone took off their toes. They're depressed. They're done with it. So we encourage them to eat. After all, they have to heal. It's a mitzvah to live and to heal them. But we can't force them or tie them down because there is autonomy. We can't even tie their hands down to take out the tube. Let's say they keep taking out the feeding tube. They keep taking it out. So say, oh, we'll tie their hands down. So one authority I read said, no, you shouldn't tie their hands down because they may be causing their death. After all, maybe she tied their hands down, they're causing their death, but they're under great duress and they are excused. If under the duress of their imminent death due to cancer or whatever it is, they feel that they don't want to eat, they're exempt from causing their death. It's true that by taking out the feeding tube and refusing to eat, they're causing their death, but since they're under great duress, they're excused. So here's some element of, it's an interesting place. It's not total autonomy. We do encourage them to eat, because we think it's the right thing. They're not dead yet. But we excuse them if they choose not to. What if he refuses to take a treatment that's good for him? So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein says, it's against Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, not that Greenblatt's Rabbi. He was a great rabbi until about 1990 when he passed away. If it's painful, he can refuse. Because again, you don't have to suffer pain. That's your choice. But if it's foolish to refuse, it's a simple treatment. He takes it. They'll live. We must force him. If it's so foolish, it's like a child. What do you mean you don't want to? It's a simple antibiotic. If you take this, you'll be cured. You'll be cured, and your foot won't fall off, and you'll live. So then we force him. But if forcing will make him anxious, forcing will drive him crazy. Anxiousness can be harmful and shouldn't be done. You see the dance that he's doing here. On the one hand, you should force people to take things that are obviously good for them. On the other hand, you have to consider the psychological effect of causing someone anxiousness, and that could be harmful. So then we may listen to their idea. One rabbi at my yeshiva in Gush wrote the following in Hebrew. Forgive the lack of translation. All right, Feinstein said that some halachos in this realm do depend on your autonomy and your idea, what you want to do. The Torah doesn't say you have to do such and such a thing. It's just that if normal people would not want to endure pain X in order to achieve result Y, then you can choose not to go through that pain. If it's normal, if it's not normal, we try to convince you otherwise. But if a lot of people would say, I would rather not go through that very painful treatment to achieve 1 month extra of life, if a lot of people would make that choice, then that's a reasonable choice. It depends on what's normal for people to choose. People have a right to refuse to be in pain. So that not everyone agrees to this. I have a rabbi, Rabbi Blech. He says the doctor has one job. His job is to heal. If a person passes out, if they have no pulse, they have to try to bring them back. If they have to bring them back again, they bring them back 10 times, they can do that. And the doctor will get upset. He said, this is ridiculous. There's no point here. It's futile. And this Rabbi Blech would say, you be quiet. Your job is to be a doctor. You get out there. You have any healing ability, you heal them. So there is such an extreme approach. However, there are a lot of other approaches that say that when it's over, it's over. How does it make this? Now I want to ask you a question. How does it make you feel when the doctor asks you, what do you want to do? I have a question for the audience. How does it make you feel when the doctor says, okay, these are the options. Mrs. Goldberg, what would you like to do? How does it make you feel?
Feel like you have control.
Okay, good. So you feel that's good, that the doctor should ask you what you want to do. He's not God. He's good. He gives you the facts. He knows the same facts you do. You have a brain also. He knows all the medical ins and outs, but once he explained the basic, in layman's terms, what's going on. So you're going to make the decision. It feels good. You have choices. Anybody else?
Yeah, it gives me the opposite. When a doctor looks at me and says to me, what do you want to do? It makes me feel like it's pretty hopeless because there's not a clear course. And I feel very insecure because if I knew what to do, I would not be at the doctor's office. And I feel like that's putting off the responsibility of the right course.
Right. So here we have two very extreme views, right? One who says, it's great. I feel like I have autonomy. And that's one of the major principles of secular ethics. Other view is that the doctor. Go ahead.
I would feel like the doctor's giving up on me and maybe I should give up on myself because he's letting me choose. Mm-hmm. So my life isn't very important anymore. I would be very depressed.
Right.
I would be very extremely nervous because I have a hard enough time deciding what to eat, much less make up my mind about what to, if my life depended on it. So I would want somebody else to make the decision, I'm sure.
Yeah. Let's think of scenario. Are there scenarios where the doctor, where it's not hopeless at all. It's a very simple treatment. And the doctor says, do this. That's it. He doesn't give you a choice. Can you think of counterexamples where the doctor doesn't give you a choice? He says, this is it. What do you mean choices? There's one course. And are there cases like that today?
I mean, if you're going, say you have a weight problem and the doctor says, well, we could do the surgery or I can give you this diet. That's one kind of a choice of option. So maybe it depends on the gravity of your illness and what the outcome. You know, it's one thing to be picking how you're going to lose the next 40 pounds, but it's another thing if you've got cancer and now you're down to the nitty gritty, you're not even informed to make a decision about which course. You can be told the courses, but a lot of times people make the choice for the wrong reason. Like you said earlier, maybe one choice is a little less pleasant, but less effective. So you might not, I don't know.
Also, there's a second opinion. You can always go to another doctor and ask his advice.
That's true.
There's also a question, is he really asking? You know, some of these so-called autonomy, it's really, sometimes I experience it as, there's a little bit of a heavy hand, like the doctor tilts, he tips the cards a little bit toward what he wants to do, so it's not completely free sometimes. I don't know, when you go in for a cold, they don't always say, well, you could take an antibiotic, but you could also just sit there and be miserable. You know, they usually will just, give you, but as you said, it's less complicated and maybe it's different. How does it make you feel? You have all these choices.
I think that the doctor sometimes asks whether you agree with him in terms of the treatment. because he wants you to feel like you have a vested interest in the decision, which is important because you're going to be more compliant if you are happy to take this treatment than if you're being forced to do it.
Yes, actually, the whole world is struggling with this right now. How do we get 70% of this country to take the vaccine? So some people say, there was a symposium in the Times Review section this week. Some people say, make it mandatory. And a lot of people say, no, don't do that. That will increase all the conspiracy theories and everything else. Give people a choice and they'll, hopefully they'll come to their senses and they'll do what needs to be done. So it's a very interesting question. I see we have a little comment there. Let's see. We have a chat. Thank you. Okay. Someone had to go.
I think there's another aspect to this, and that is, what do we do when the doctor says there's nothing to do? This happened twice with my husband because of his age. And luckily, the first time he was having a radiological exam, and our doctor sat with him. And the doctor said, well, what will you give him for this? And he said, nothing. And the doctor said, well, instead of being 75, what if he was 57? He said, oh, then I would do thus, thus, and thus. So I have learned, and there was another incident, which I honestly don't remember, but I think we older people need to be aware that some of these doctors, just because of our age, will do nothing. And I think that's important for us to know.
Although that's things are improving, but years ago, I agree with you, that could be an issue. Years ago, if somebody fell at 95, they wouldn't put them through rehab. They wouldn't do a hip replacement. But, we have some people in our congregation who have gone through several orthopedic operations in the last number of years, over 90, and then did great also. So things are changing. But yeah, that's a great point that we have to make sure people are avoiding any kind of age discrimination. That's great. And also the ability to, the autonomy in the sense of, even when the doctor says what's going on and what you should do, to go to a next step. Well, I want to move a little bit further at this point. what else? Malfeasance. Now, so what if we say it may only have 1% chance of working? So Beecham and Childress, this medical ethics book, he says, well, that's futile. But halacha, the Jewish law, might say, again, I'm not the ultimate expert on this topic, but they might say at some point, well, if there's a chance of saving a life, it's worth it. So because of our high value we place on saving human life, we might look at 1% chance as not futile, but a possibility. So there's a difference in that particular value. Is there a difference between hydration, nutrition, and other treatments? This is a tough one. In other words, somebody might say, look, this patient is so sick. They have no mental functioning that we can detect. There's no chance of them getting alert ever. They're going to die. They have different situations. They're going to lead to death. No question about it. So we're not going to give them any more antibiotics. So a lot of people would say, all right, not going to treat the pneumonia. All right. It's withholding. You're not doing anything to cause your death. You're withholding something. It's different. It's a passive euthanasia. Okay. But what about, you say, well, it's futile. It's no point. Let's just take them off everything, including the feeding tube and IVs and the nasal feeding tube, et cetera. So what about that? So the Supreme Court said, you can refuse hydration and nutrition. Or is it starving the patient? So here we get to it, right? We know if I took someone, put them in a room, I didn't take a hammer or a sledgehammer or a gun, just put them in a room. I didn't feed them for a week and they died. So I'm guilty of murder or some form of murder, right? I don't know if it's murder one or murder, but in Jewish law and general law, I killed them. I put them in a room. I didn't give them any food. But what if you take someone who's on his last leg and you don't feed him? So do we say that's part of the dying process? Dying people don't eat. When you're half dead, you don't start chewing. You don't say, hey, I'm hungry, give me a hamburger. When you're dying, you die. And people would, or is it part of death? If you don't feed them, will they die from starvation or will they die from other things? Okay, right? So it's a very interesting question. So some rabbis say, it's a problem, it's a debate. on why feed the patient. Why would you feed them all together? Is it feeding them? Maybe it helps. It helps fight the pain, or it's a bare necessity. It was both Rabbi Feinstein and Rabbi Urbach say you should always feed them. It's a bare necessity, or maybe by feeding them, you'll give them more strength. They can fight the pain. So a lot of rabbis say you always have to keep feeding. But you know, does that get to a ridiculous point where, I don't know, maybe you're lengthening their indignity of being in a vegetative state? So most say we must feed. However, Rabbi Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, who you may not have heard of, but he died recently and there was a lot of press about him. You can look him up. I'm talking about in the last month or so he died. He disagreed. He viewed it as prolonging life, prolonging death, and that the patient dies from general maladies, not starvation. Rabbi Herschel Schechter is quoted by Rabbi Jason Wiener. Jason Wiener is one of the chief chaplains. He's really a person really giving chaplains a lot of good press these days. He's a rabbi and chaplain in California, and he wrote a wonderful book on Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision Making. And he visited Memphis not too long ago at the JCC. Anyway, so he quotes Rabbi Schechter in a private conversation as agreeing that you don't always have to keep the feeding going. Maybe you're just prolonging death. So that doesn't mean that that's the bottom line. For some, for Rabbi Schechter's students, maybe that's me, that would be permissible to withdraw a feeding tube. And for others, they would say that, well, most rabbis disagree. The great rabbis, Rabbi Feinstein, Rabbi Urbach, they said you always have to feed. It's a bare necessity. It's interesting. Now, is there a difference between passive euthanasia and active euthanasia? So this is a famous, obviously we don't want to kill anybody. That's active euthanasia. I mentioned to Francine before. But what about passive euthanasia? What if I remove the treatment of the antibiotics? They'll die from pneumonia, which is good because they're sitting there in a ventilator. They have no consciousness and it's a very unpleasant state to be in. So they say, I thought it was in this passage. Let's see, it's in here somewhere. If there was something going on that was preventing someone's death, let's say you were a medieval person and you believe that because that guy is mowing his lawn outside, that's why he can't die in peace. If he would stop mowing his lawn, then he would die. So says the Sefer Hasidim, okay, you can ask the guy, excuse me, could you please stop mowing that lawn? My father, he was trying to die in peace. Could you cut that out? So he said, oh, I'll turn off the mower for 5 minutes. So he turns off for 5 minutes, patient dies. So is that hastening the death? Is that active euthanasia? No, it's passive. He stopped mowing his lawn. And it was all the way over there. Now, what if I could take out the feeding tube or take out the breathing tube and that would stop his, that would cause his death? Is it the same as the mowing the lawn? So some say, well, wait a second. Since it is, since the feeding tube is right there in his body, it's not like the guy outside mowing the lawn. It's different. So that's the question. What if it's an impediment that's attached to the body? So most people say that if you could extubate and he won't, and the doctor says he won't die immediately, that it's okay. Or maybe you could turn down the oxygen to a certain level that's normal. In other words, you don't have to give him so much oxygen, you give him less. So there are ways of weaning someone off of a tube. But the debate is it just removing an impediment? Or is it like almost active because it's so attached to their body because it's inside their throat? Is there a difference between routine and ordinary care? Here we get to a very important distinction between general, different types of medical ethics. So again, most of the rabbis said that it's a routine thing like feeding them, you got to do it. If it's something like antibiotics, that's a little more unusual, or cancer treatment, you don't have to do it. You don't have to give them any more cancer treatments if they're going to die anyway. So is there a difference? Beecham and Childress, the medical ethicists that are so lauded, distinction between ordinary and extraordinary measures is morally irrelevant. Who cares if it's a feeding tube or a gastric tube intubation or whether it's hydration. If it's burdensome and it's not beneficial, forget about it. Don't do it. They don't see a difference in withholding food or an antibiotic. They clearly see that. The secular ethicists don't see a difference between withholding food, withholding antibiotics. They don't make a distinction between ordinary treatment and extraordinary treatment. They don't think that just because they're under your care, you have to feed them. If you're going to withdraw, you withdraw. If it's okay to withdraw because it's better that they die, then it's okay to withdraw anything, including food. Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz disagrees. He says, what do you mean? You don't withhold natural things. It's a natural thing to eat. So don't, but unnatural things like medicines, that you could withhold. He was a chief rabbi in England. So here's the distinction. In secular ethics, we say, what's the outcome? When you withhold this thing, he's going to die anyway. If it's death by withholding treatment, then it is so, whether extraordinary or not. If you're going to cause the death by withholding, it doesn't matter what you're withholding. And Jewish ethics says, wait, the act is also important. Is it an act of neglect? We are more process-oriented. We ask, is this halachically permitted to fail to feed them? Is it somehow indirectly or too directly causing their death? It's a different sort of approach. It doesn't recognize that there's a mitzvah to heal or that there's a mitzvah to care for those under your treatment by certain means. So it's a very important debate about feeding. And again, there's Rav Schechter, Rav Goldberg seem to agree with the secular ethicist, but for many rabbis, there's a debate here about feeding, whether it's considered neglect or starvation, or whether it's considered just helping them die in a dignified way. And the general question is, when does the obligation to heal cease? Secular approach might be, if it's not efficacious, if it's not beneficial, then you can do it. And in other words, what good is it? The doctor will ask, is it futile? Is there any point in this, in feeding them? Are they going to get better? Are they going to say hello to their children? Nothing. And the Jewish approach raises the following question. Must you always heal? Or sometimes the obligation to heal must be set aside and the obligation to love and give them a good death or prevent suffering takes over. The question is prolonging life always prolonging suffering? So here's another question. Let's say someone's in this state. They're on an intubation. You try to get their attention. Hello, mom, are you there? Hello. They can't hear anything. So in such a case, is prolonging life equal to prolonging suffering? So here's the question. Is being in a state of dying, is that suffering? Is being on an intubated by definition suffering? If the doctor, the healthcare for everybody says, mom is comfortable, everything's fine, nobody's suffering. But you say, no, the very state of dying is suffering. Or the state of being on an intubated, if you ever see someone intubated, you know, I can't even imagine putting something down my throat, right? Is there a difference between painful and suffering? Does it have to be painful? You want to relieve a painful existence. What if we say it's not painful, but it's indignant. Is that the right word? It's undignified. It is a state of being in such a lowly state where you're it's a despicable thing many people wouldn't want to endure. Is that sort of a more metaphysical kind of suffering? And maybe we should stop it. We should prevent it. We should try to mitigate it. So that's one of the big differences. So what I wanted to point out was that, you know, in many cases, Jewish law and general law and general ethics will come to the same conclusions. Like Rabbi Goldberg and Beauchamp came to the same conclusion about removing a feeding tube. They both thought you could do it. But I just want to point out that sometimes Jewish ethics, which you say Jewish ethics are, what's the difference between Jewish ethics and non-Jewish ethics? It's ethics. We contemplate what's appropriate and we do it. What's the big difference? I wanted to show you that sometimes it is a little different because, again, their major principles of autonomy at the top, and justice and non-malfeasance might be a little different than our mitzvah-oriented thing. Well, I have a mitzvah. I have to heal. I have a mitzvah not to cause suffering. I have an obligation to lengthen the death, but I have an obligation to heal. This obligation, mitzvah orientation, is a little different than their general principles of ethics. I just want to point out that you know, while Judaism and general ethics sort of overlap, and there's certainly we're very proud of the fact that it can work in tandem so much. I point out that it's not always exactly the same. And we come to it differently. We have different set of sources and values. So even though we live in a world which, hopefully, even after last Wednesday, a world which is, you know, generally supports our values, but we have to remember that sometimes our values could be slightly different than those of the general society. That's my presentation.